This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 40 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
A very, very big All Souls Podcast welcome to our guest this episode. You definitely know of him. If you've listened to our show for a while, you've heard him speak. We are so happy to welcome back composer for A Discovery of Witches, Mr. Rob Lane.
Hi.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us again.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is ours. We are both huge music fans, music lovers, and my favorite CDs, if you will, even growing up, or I guess back then it was tapes, my favorite music was soundtracks.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, musicals, but soundtracks.
Yeah.
Specifically from movies, from film, or TV.
Mine too.
Well, and I never understood. I mean, a lot of people like, oh, I like the jingle here. I like that piece, you know, when he's saving her on the mountain or whatever. But it's not something, I think it's a common like. I just don't know that, I just don't know how common, because it's not usually, like everyone, all my friends in high school and college are talking about their favorite groups. And I would say, well, mine is Last of the Mohicans. And they're like, that's not a group.
Yeah. So. But I think there are a lot of people like you, you know, who get enormous amounts from watching stuff and hearing the music that is either on, you know, whatever it is, Netflix or films they see or TV. You know, there's a lot of interest in soundtracks now. So yeah, I'm delighted you're one of them.
I can't help it, and I would say, and this a nice little entree into our discussion. Is that, yes, well, I love soundtracks so much, something that makes it even stronger, more of an emotional impact when you listen, and thus stays with you longer, is if it's something like A Discovery of Witches, which is an adaptation from a book series, that if you already have that emotional tie-in from the book, and then you go to watch the adaptation, I'm probably less critical, meaning as far as adaptation goes, because I know, you know, choices have to be made. You cannot literally take a book and put it into TV. I get it. And I think people get it. But even someone who is quite critical about, you know, is the adaptation going to live up to my expectation or something like that? Even the most critical book fan turn TV show fan, I think they still bring that story with them.
Yeah.
And that's why they're critical, right? They really love this and they have high hopes for it.
Yeah.
But then when you see the TV show or a TV adaptation and that music is something that is new. So the story they're seeing, yes, it's a visual medium now, of course, but it's not just visual. It's aural, it's audio. Mm. And so when you add in, you know, you can follow all the casting announcements like, oh, it's Teresa Palmer. She's going to be our Diana. You can follow along. You are familiar with her acting. You can see her as we have in season one and know kind of what to expect from her acting wise in season two.
Sure.
But the thing you're never ready for, besides maybe costumes and, you know, and a beautiful set design, is you never know how the music is going to affect you ever. Mm-hmm. Since you have completed season one, was there anything that you found harder or easier for composing for season two, since you'd already completed season one?
I felt that we, you know, got right some key themes in episode one, and the sort of Matthew theme, the Matthew Diana theme. There were a lot of sort of leitmotifs and ideas that we kind of nailed, I hope, in episode one that were obviously going to come back in season two. And they do, but I would say that at least half of season two needed to be new, because, I mean, specifically, we go back in time and we're in the Elizabethan period, and that did present quite a challenge for me, partly because the producers of the show were keen that I, for want of a better word, didn't just get out the lutes, as they said.
Sure.
In fact, that was specifically
you can't just You can't just go play Green Sleeves for an entire season.
Indeed. And it was quite funny because they actually got quite worried ahead of time. They got quite worried before I started composing, like, you know, we're a bit worried about, you know, the period music in this and so on. And we emphatically feel that it shouldn't be period, by which I think they meant that they didn't want it to be cliched in its approach to period, you know. So they would say, look, you know, at its most straightforward, just because we're in the Elizabethan age, do reassure us you're not going to start using lots of Elizabethan instruments and start getting the lutes and the viols out and so on. Why can't it continue to be electronic? To which I said, yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think in a way, the point of the music in A Discovery of Witches is that it's aspiring to be relatively timeless. You know, I didn't want either to do a completely super modern electronic score with lots of bleeps and drum loops, nor did I want it to be, very much a classical, solely a classical experience. So I think we had already settled on a hybrid sound. Which a lot of film scores are these days, a lot of TV and film scores are these days, a mixture of electronics and acoustic classical instruments. And I think they were just keen to make sure that that continued in season two. And I'll give you an example. In season two, so once they arrive in Elizabethan London and Diana realises that Matthew is going to have to inhabit this character called Matthew Royden that he was in the past, there's a kind of electronic, there's a sort of spy theme there, a court theme. Matthew is the kind of dark court spy, the assistant to Lord Burleigh, the Queen's dark shadow. I deliberately made that start with quite strange electronic sounds, and then the strings come in a bit later. So that motif was there. But then, for example, when they go out on the for the walk around London, I mean, you know, I have to acknowledge absolutely the influence of Handel on that piece. And Handel also is obviously comes 200 years later, but it is a kind of very much a sort of London classical piece. So, I mean, there wasn't a set rule about how to do it, but they, you know, and we ended up settling on, you know, this sense that we're going to try and avoid period cliches, and we're going to try and keep it feeling modern, but I would say trying to keep it feeling relatively timeless, you know, so that you can't completely place it in one realm or the other.
I was thinking in my mind as you were beginning that description, and you were saying kind of as you were getting toward the describing the sound that you had settled on, absolutely, I think timeless is not only the best description for what I heard, at least, or experienced, but also for what makes sense for the show. Because yeah, there's all kinds of time periods being either experienced or traveled to or alluded to, but and that just goes more to support the idea that to make it even more, the story is actually timeless if you look at it broadly.
So for example, I'm going to give you another example. I mean, you know, I settled on a sound for Lord Burleigh that was literally a kind of one evolving sort of synth patch that to me just had this really extraordinary timbre to it. And, you know, I that was the realm that I wanted to start, the musical space that I wanted to start with when Matthew is being his kind of Matthew Royden self, you know, in episode one, when he goes and oversees the torture of Catholic suspects, you know, it starts with this electronic patch, this sound, this kind of ambient sound. But then, you know, I did deliberately put some sort of handbells in there, which are sounds. They were done spookily, but they are sounds that you kind of associate with the period. But it's just not me playing, as you said, you know, green sleeves on on handbells. You know, yeah. So I think, and you know, later on, when they go to Bohemia, I mean, it was quite funny that when we got to Ep 7, it was quite funny because I came to compose it, and you know, again, we wanted to use the same hybrid electronic dark palette, but they'd actually already recorded a couple of musicians in shot playing the viol and the lute.
Oh no!
And they haven't even asked me about it. And I said, "Well, I am going to have to get the lutes out and the viols out for that one."
Oh no! They stabbed themselves in the foot. Oh no!
You've gone and put period musicians in shock, and it was quite funny because it was really quite a funny thing because I don't know if you remember, but in episode seven, they arrive in Bohemia, and they get shown in to meet the king of Bohemia, and as they go in, they pass these two musicians a couple of times in shot, and these two musicians were just extras, probably with musical skills, in the sense that they could bow the viol and they could look like they were strumming the lute, but they weren't actually playing anything at all. So I then had to match their hand movements to make it look like they were playing, and I ended up, by pure chance, I found a piece of John Dowland on YouTube, and I put, because it was a duo, so I typed in duo viol and lute into YouTube, and I came up with this. I was taken to a performance by this Polish couple who specialise in that music, and I put it against the picture, and it completely worked with these extras. So then, having realised that it would work, I then re-recorded my own version of a very famous piece by John Dowland, who absolutely is an Elizabethan composer. So it was quite a funny thing to find that I did need to do some, you know, I did need to get the lutes out on occasion. And I've got nothing against lutes. I love, you know. But I think what they were worried about, there's a show here in England that was hugely popular called Blackadder.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they did get the lutes out all the time. I think that has kind of stuck in people's minds as kind of like almost like a satire of what period music might sound like. So you have recorders and lutes and things like that, and they absolutely didn't want that. So that was, to be honest, that was the main thing I was told about writing the new music for season two. Don't get the lutes out.
except for this one scene, you got to get the lute out.
Because there's a lute shot. Yeah.
What was their reaction when you said, you guys know that you did this, right?
Yeah, they thought it was funny that I pointed out that they actually had used that. And that was the right decision. You know, but I think, you know, it's an absolutely fair point that they wanted to make, the producers and directors wanted to make, was that we don't want to go too far down that road. You know, that this is that these characters are modern. They may have traveled back in time, but they are essentially modern, and the show is for a modern audience. So, you know, be careful. And so I find that actually there are chord progressions in Tudor music which are absolutely stunning, and which I did, if you like, smuggle into some of the stuff that I did. You know, I mean, as I said, the bit where the scene where they walk around London and look at Old St. Paul's really is a tribute to Handel. There's no way that I can deny that. And that is period music. And it's interesting that no one had any trouble with me doing that. So I think it's just a question of how much, you know, in the ingredients of the score, how much of it is going to have period gestures, and how much is going to be, you know, very modern and stripped back and sometimes non-melodic, you know. So that's something that you do with every show. You know, you have to find this you have to find this balance.
Absolutely. And you actually took the words out of my, right out of my brain. It's, I understand, and it makes sense, the concern of production, or just not wanting it to go in a certain direction or have a certain sound, especially given season one and given the fact that you said the words like verbatim out of my brain, that these are modern characters.
Yeah, they are modern characters. But in the case of Matthew, you know, obviously he's an old character as well. He's been around for hundreds of years. And one of the themes that I call the Knights of Lazarus theme. Every time they talk about that, you know, a very distant founding of the Knights of Lazarus, you know, I went into a mode that was it was string music. So it's string music with a cello solo. It does have a kind of almost Byzantine quality to it that was quite deliberate. It's a bit like they're talking about the Crusades, you know, when this Legion of Knights was formed. So, you know, I'm kind of consciously kind of trying to make it sound old, but the way that it's done is very stripped back and kind of contemporary, you know, and draws on influences that I have with composers like John Taverner, for example, you know, who is a recent composer who went back and found a lot of inspiration in old Byzantine music. But it was, when he did it, it was kind of a sort of reworking, a modernization, you know. So my thoughts and my interests are absolutely to kind of create something timeless. And sometimes that needs to go right back into the past. And if I've had, sometimes I've had criticisms of period scores where they've gone so far the other way, i.e. make it completely a synth score, that actually you don't actually get any, it's so concerned with trying to be modern that you actually don't get any sense of the past at all, and you're not transported. In fact, it sounds like you're in Blade Runner, you know, you might as well be in Blade Runner, you know. There have been cases where I think people have gone too far the other way. So, you know, I mean, for me, part of the pleasure of watching a period drama or a film is to be transported to that past. But I think that productions these days are hugely concerned to just basically avoid cliches. You know, I mean, I wouldn't, if I was watching Gladiator, for example, it's like, I love that score. And I think it works brilliantly in the film. And it was kind of quite a sort of yardstick for signalling how you could do a score that had, you know, it had the antique instruments, it had the Chinese dulcimer in it, it had the strings, it had the choir, it had the Armenian duduk, which is an extremely ancient instrument. But the arrangements, how it was presented, was modern. You know, and I think that's the challenge, is to find that balance.
We believe that you've struck that balance because it is everything that you've said. It is absolutely not cliche. And it is, we, in our experience and to our ears, and from the little bit we've interacted with other fans online, people are in love with it.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's that other layer of, you know, we can hear it. Like, you know, we watched a few episodes before the soundtrack dropped. Mm. But so we could hear, obviously, your creation as the story progressed, as the season progressed. And whenever we heard something, you know, new or familiar, you're like, oh my gosh, that's the wine glasses, or oh my gosh, that's the four note descending theme that we hear all over, right?
And
we knew it was coming. We're like, oh great, it means it's probably gonna have in the soundtrack. And so we were able to kind of tell, hear where you were going. Obviously we didn't hear everything until the soundtrack dropped, but absolutely anything we've interacted online with other people who, especially once the soundtrack dropped, it's like there are some definite favorites, which I will get to.
And I've got a couple of stories about probably one of your favorites. Because this is actually very interesting. Would you like me to talk about Time in a Bottle?
Yes, please talk about anything and everything you want to talk about. We can start there.
it kind of carries on from your period. You know, your questions about and what we've just been talking about, period. So if you watch episode six, Diana and Matthew get married, and then we cut to a scene where you have them dancing, and then it goes to their wedding night, okay? Now, what we originally had was that there was, in that dancing scene, we had a violinist in shot, and we had a lute player in shot, right? And they actually played music, and they were really good. They were professional musicians. Okay, this is quite an interesting story. They played an ancient, quite an old piece of dance music, and then and Matthew and Diana danced to it, and then what happened was, in the first edit that I saw, it then went to a commercial track for their first night together, right? And everybody said, this is too much. This is too different. We're going from period music to this ultra-modern, contemporary, female, breathy vocal, yeah? And it just doesn't seem to work. Rob, what can you do to unify this? Well, what actually happened was that the music supervisor, Ollie White, came up with this. He just came up with this suggestion. Why don't we use the Jim Croce song, Time in a Bottle? Because it's got a lovely sentiment which boils down to, you're the only one I want to go through time with, right? Which is a lovely, beautiful sentiment when you think about Matthew and Diana. So it was by pure fluke, the music in the Baroque that they'd done, the Baroque music that they'd done, and Time in a Bottle were both in what we call 6/8, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I said, okay, well, if I play Time in a Bottle over that dance sequence, it just about works, okay? And so what we did was, by editing and by me changing, always being aware that whenever the violinist is in shot, you have to make it look like she's playing what I'm playing, otherwise you get it. We literally changed all the music there. And sadly, those two players are now playing Time in a Bottle. But what it did do, which was really nice, was it set up Time in a Bottle to be an instrumental version, an instrumental waltz, and then the vocal comes in on their wedding night. And the vocalist called Julia Church did an absolutely wonderful job. And I actually changed the song as well. So I took bits from the second verse in the original song and made that the chorus because I preferred those lines. So I did a bit of creative changing, if you like, of the Jim Croce original. And that's what we get. And that's what we end up with in episode 6. So, you know, a lot of polishing and editing went on behind the scenes to make that work because it wasn't what was originally envisaged for that scene. And then what we did was, for the soundtrack, I so loved what Julia did for the vocal that she and I then, once I'd finished the series, we, in December, we kind of did a full-length version of the song because we knew it would be the most popular thing on the album, which it seems to be at the moment.
Yes, and that it absolutely is one of the most popular that we see people talking about. And thank you for sharing that, because those are the things that we don't, you know, you will never know from just watching.
No, you wouldn't. And we don't want you to know, but I've just told you.
I know the song, not memorized, but, you know, I know the main lyrics, and I know the core, at least the main chorus. And so obviously I also could tell, I didn't know it was the second verse or words from the second verse, but I could tell that the words of the chorus were slightly different. Now, like the original, it goes from minor to major, right? Yep. That's not different.
Yeah.
But yes, it has up new words, but didn't you also play with the melody of the chorus?
Yes, I did. Yes. I mean, can I be honest here and say that I didn't particularly like the chorus in the original? And so I felt that the chorus was what needed to be changed. So, you know, like the minor section is beautiful and sad. And I personally, for my taste, found that the line, I think in the original, that goes something like, and there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do. Yeah. That didn't work for me over the lovemaking scene, shall we say, right? It just wasn't either sexy or poignant enough. Okay. It wasn't sensual. So I felt that I'm going to take some creative license here. And I basically, what I did was I took lines from the second verse, which are something around, I basically took the line about, I'd save every day like a treasure. And then again and again, I'd spend them with you. And then the key what I wanted to say was, and I've looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time with. And that seemed to be the sentiment that we wanted to get through. So actually in the song, as it is on the album, I then went to Julia and said, oh God, I've taken two lines out of the second verse. So we're going to have to think of two new lines to replace them. So actually in the second verse now, it starts as it did. And if I could make days last forever, and if words could make wishes come true, and then I've now inserted two of my own lines, we'd walk through the fields of ripening corn and time would flow through us anew. That's so those aren't, I'm afraid, sorry, Jim, I've added those lines.
Oh, no, it was, I could obviously tell, only because I grew up with the song, I could definitely tell that some of the words were different. It's one thing to like think you know the words of something and start singing along, and then you're like, oops, you know, if you're singing something and it doesn't match up, my first thought is, oh, maybe I misremember the words. Okay, that's fair. But when I start singing and I get the melody or the chorus wrong, I know for sure something has changed. And so it was so refreshing and so like, wow, talk about making something, you know, even more new. And something else that maybe production didn't think about this, and maybe you guys didn't take it into consideration. It was definitely not the focal point of this, of these scenes. But something else is that just the mention of time. Yes, they're time travelers. They're out of time. You know, they're modern characters. Not the wedding night part, but the wedding and the everything up until the wedding night of that sequence. We have Philippe. And Philippe, there's also this sense, at least this is what I got out of it, in addition to the obvious Matthew and Diana, you have Philippe who's, you know, in his own time. Mm-hmm. And we know, this is as a book reader, I'm bringing this in, obviously. We know that he, and this is not a spoiler because, well, it's not a spoiler because it was mentioned in season one. We know that he dies in the 1940s at the hands of the Nazis. And so there's that, which you had a very nice jazz dance scene, you know, very nice 40s music in season one when they're dancing with Isabeau. But here you have the marriage of Diana and Matthew, and Philippe is there. He's always present. Like he's truly always present in Matthew's life, in Isabeau's life. But with him here, the music, the lyrics have an extra potential extra layer of meaning if you want to look there. And that is Philippe, while he's not traveling and he's not out of time, the love of his life is in a different time. And later on, as you know, as people see, you know, when he's writing a letter and that letter suddenly appears in the future. So there is this idea of time shifting almost, even with him. Yeah. And he is this big, amazing, glorious piece character who is present from from season one through when we get to season three. But he's just not physically there. But his emotional presence is there. So I even looked at this scene, or this song, I should say, these sequences, except for the wedding night, obviously. Him being there, even though he wasn't the focus, there's that just extra beautiful layer that you could attribute to him.
Yeah.
And Isabeau for later.
Yeah, and that's a really important thing that goes all the way through episode six, which was kind of in a way that probably one of the most emotional and important to get right. And it does end with another equally very important cue where basically Philippe kind of writes to Isabeau for the last time. you know, and it is very poignant. You know, he's kind of saying that, you know, whatever is going to become of me, I kind of accept. And he kind of half knows or suspects Matthew's role in his own death. You know, in that episode, we did need to have this. I mean, I chose to kind of have these very kind of reverberant piano notes and a little bit of voices to kind of get across the idea that when he writes, there's a scene at the beginning where he writes, and then we cut to Isabeau in the present, and she just kind of seems to sense something, you know, and the music is doing all that work. It's basically a call across the centuries, isn't it? So that was really good to do. It's a very the whole episode 6 was an extremely emotional episode, because you've got the wedding, and you've got this furious kind of conflict between Matthew and Philippe as they duel, and he's saying to him, "I want to know what you know about my future," and of course Matthew doesn't want to tell him what he knows. And then, you know, you have finally Philippe signing off, and you know, and sort of accepting his fate. And it's interesting that that theme of timelessness, you know, comes back again to what we were talking about earlier. That, you know, there's a cue on season one album called Origins, which again is like a string cue, but very much like it's sort of modern but old at the same time, and it's very much intended to be about time, you know, and what these vast expanses of time feel like. So when Diana leave to go to Bohemia, and then Philippe rides back home, I start with that theme, that origins theme, because for me it was a way of going, it's just bringing to the listener the sense that so much time has passed. You know, people are talking and writing to each other across centuries. So I needed something to express that musically.
In the, you spoke of Time in a Bottle. So of course that covers the kind of, I guess you call it the wedding to wedding night sequence.
Yeah.
But on the soundtrack, there is a track, I think it's track 13, called The Wedding.
Oh yeah.
I think it's just before we hear, or yeah, at least on the soundtrack, it's just before Time in a Bottle. This is what I heard. So it starts with our theme, of mm-hmm. course, and that's just, it's magic. And then it gets to a point, and it's not the longest piece, obviously. It, you know, it's short and sweet-ish, but not the shortest. But the thing that stood out to me more than the theme was those repeated fifths that go da 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 da, and then it went on and it repeated it, and it the music sounded so much, it was beautiful as a wedding should be, but it I have the key wrong, but it should have been a fifth, I hope, but it felt like coming home or coming to rest, but also in between literally a major fifth in a major key, it sounded or felt like there were touches of sadness in there. And it sounded to me toward the end of that, even though there's this beautiful piece, you know, celebrating a wedding, it was a touch of sadness, almost like acknowledging the future sadness before it shifted back to repeat those fifths again.
Yeah, I think that might be, no, that's, it's all really, I totally hear what you're saying. I think possibly, I think that I might be coming at it from a point of view of again wanting to share, wanting to avoid being another set of cliches, which is when you're when you just are hyper romantic. You know, I'm not sure that I could give many examples of it, except it was sort of, it's there in older films, and I think that what's great about having, like, you know, you've got the four note theme played on the piano, the thing that you wrote, what's so good about having nailed that theme and found that it works in episode one is it then kind of almost works in any situation. It's a sort of, you often don't have much time to write these cues, and you just kind of plumb, you just jump in and instinctively, right, well, what happens if I play this theme you know, poignantly on the piano. And then you're going, oh, well, that's great. And then the door opens and, oh, okay, I need to kind of go off in a different direction now. And I need to, you know, and then she comes sweeping out of her of the door and it's this beautiful moment. The bride is here. And then it has to come back down again to the, you know, underscoring the wedding again. Oh, I, my four note theme on the piano is still working under that. And it's kind of delivering poignancy, I think. I mean, people cry at weddings, you know, don't they? They cry because it's a kind of moment. It's such a life-changing moment for so many people. It is obviously hugely romantic, but it's also romantic because it is poignant. It's so poignant. Of people making these vows to each other and the sort of the seriousness of that. And then you think of all the stuff they've been through and so on. So for me, it has more emotional depth. You know, I did want it to be, it has more emotional depth when it has that poignancy. I mean, that's just the way I sort of seem to feel about romantic stuff. So that's why it came out that way.
Oh, I would agree with that. Any composer worth their salt can give pretty. Anyone can compose pretty. It's finding a way to, one of the ways is, as you said, in your words, if you can add poignancy to it, that adds depth, that adds more realism. Yeah. And I think that you absolutely, oh man, you achieved that with this. Whew.
Thank you. I mean, that's, I suppose it's a pure, it's literally a completely purely emotional point of view. You know, it's like, well, what does it for me? You know, so it does have these triumphant chords at the end, but they're still, it's just trying to be very human about it and avoid, for want of a better word, any sense of kind of Cinderella, you know, of getting too treacly and too sweet and that doesn't do it for me. so that's why I didn't write it. And luckily they accepted it as, well, they didn't have any problems with it. But I think, you know, that's how I feel about that stuff. I wanted to for it to be poignant and romantic, not just gushy and romantic.
It did not come across gushy. Mm. It definitely came across romantic, but it also came across as ominous. And you had, I think, would it be correct to say or fair to say, you had a wider dissonant palette this season?
Yeah, I mean,
you had a lot. I think, I don't know if you had more freedom or, you know, there was danger in season one, don't get me wrong, but you're introducing an entirely new type of danger. It's the time period that itself that is more dangerous.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that takes up, one thing that comes up in season two, which wasn't there before, which is obviously a big thread, which is, you know, the whole blood rage. So the Oxford murders, you know, it felt to me like, you know, that was one of the key things I had to get was, you know, a sound or a series of sounds, which I chose in the end to be extremely dissonant, you know, for getting across the blood rage, you know, and you sense a little bit of it in Matthew in, well, there's a tiny little bit in episode one where he kind of almost freaks out on Kit. And then it sort of, he gets more and more prone to it in episode two and three. And then episode four, you've got the blood rage. It starts with that, with the vampire attack, you know, and then in six, Matthew completely gives into, well, he can't control it any longer. So, you know, there was, as you say, that absolutely begged for dissonance for me. I mean, that, and so I also really like doing that kind of stuff. And I, you know, it needs to be dark. It is really dark. So, yeah. So I definitely had that challenge.
One of the things that readers are especially looking forward to in season two was, or will be looking if they haven't seen the episode yet, is meeting Cora.
Oh yeah.
So what was your inspiration when you first saw that? What was your inspiration, not just from the visual, obviously, but what was your idea in composing for the Fire Drake Emerges?
Yeah, I was really pleased with this cue. what was the inspiration? Okay, there was one bit. Okay, early on in season nine, they discover that Diana is pregnant, and Goody Allsop puts her hands down towards Diana's stomach, and I decided, okay, I'm just going to go straight there. I'm not going to do anything complicated. I'm going to do modern female voices. You know, the kind of ha, 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 hoo, ha, 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 ha. So I just thought, you know, this is what I'm trying to express is I'm just going to be really straightforward. This is the humming of female energy, female power. You know, she's and so when that scene comes back, when we get to the Fardrake scene, you know, she's going through these knots. And the point that the story seems to be making to me was that part of her ability to master these knots is because she is humming, as Goody Allsop says, with a new power, which is obviously the fact that she's pregnant. It's her female power. And so that's why I decided to start with that again. You hear the voices at the start of that, and then you hear this ha 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 kind of sound. This da 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 da. Yeah.
Yes.
And okay, so I am a huge fan of John Adams, the American composer, your greatest living composer, in my opinion. And I have sung in a choir, which used a lot of those vocal techniques, in a piece of his that I would recommend everybody to listen to called Harmonium, which is absolutely incredible. It's two of the pieces are settings of poems by Emily Dickinson. And I would say that Harmonium is possibly in my top 10 of all time favorite pieces, partly because I've sung in it and partly because I just think it's the most incredible music. So I hope John Adams wouldn't be unhappy if I said that that kind of stuff. I don't know. It was just in my musical palette. I'm thinking female power and energy, and I've got this kind of background of singing this piece in John Adams, and I love what it does, and I'm, you know, I haven't taken directly from it. I've just used the vocal techniques, which is, so I had Clara Ketelaars around again, the young woman who sang Song of Home last year on season one. And we just built up tracks of her doing this. Da 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 da, you know. And then I built the strings on it, and then I suppose I did go a bit Harry Potter when Cora arrived. but that, you know, so it's kind of one of those things where it, you know, you start. I'd already had the idea for female voices. I had the background of singing the John Adams piece Harmonium. You know, I love Harry Potter. I probably in my composing mind put those all together, and that's what came out.
It was so effective and so gorgeous, and I definitely heard that da 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 da. And so you have that, you know, vocal line or vocal build, and it just as the fire drake, you know, physically emerges from Diana, I felt this layering of sound, and it grew as she came out, and it was just amazing. It just all worked.
Thank you for that, because I, you know, there are some cues which you deliver and you know that they're kind of okay, or you did the best you could in the time. And I spent a long time on that cue, and it went through four versions actually, before it got there, with the director properly pointing out, oh, well, look, you know, look at this bit where she, you know, she's managing these knots, and then she loses. You know, you need to score that bit where she almost drops the thread, and then you need to score this sense of excitement, and then this kind of massive power of Cora coming out of her, you know, and being her familiar. And I, you know, it's it draws from lots of different impulses in my musical background, you know. So and you're writing this stuff so fast that you're kind of not asking. I mean, you're not asking yourself too much where it's coming from. Although it was very deliberate. I think because at the doing the kind of Diana's pregnant at the beginning, it was a bit like, okay, well, right, we've done this hoo ha hoo ha hoo ha. Right. So when that thread next comes in the show, let's develop that again. So that's what I did. And I was really pleased with how it came out, you know, because often you start stuff and it doesn't always come out as good.
Well, and I have to ask about Transcendence. How did you, obviously you watched it first, you watched to see, and you probably had the script. This is kind of an obvious question, but what did you want to achieve besides Transcendence for that piece?
Okay, so this is really interesting again, because, you know, Fire Drake Emerges took 4 goes. I think Transcendence took 5 or maybe even 6. And I was told, you've got to deliver the best cue you've ever written for this.
Holy crap.
No pressure. So I said, no pressure there then. And I think that, you know, having done a lot of shows over the years, you try things and some things kind of remain with you in your memory as things which work. And I wanted a sense of a dialogue, firstly. So it was as simple as there are 2 people in the room, Diana's the violin, he's the cello. Or you can think of them the other way around, whoever you want to think of. And it's going to start as a duet. And I'm going to try and have this dee-da-da, dee-da-da, dee-da-dee-da-da, you know, this kind of sequence thing. And I'm going to try and stay on that for as long as possible. So what I did was, you know, you hear it firstly with the violin on its own, and then it repeats with the cello joining it, and then the 2 of them carry on, and the strings, you know, it changes key and the strings change. And I kind of wanted to keep that going for as long as possible. You know, because what you're seeing is, as you're writing it, you're seeing, well, is that still working? And it's like, yes, it is. Okay, well, we'll keep going with that. We'll keep going with that. And then you know, later it changes and it needs to become a much darker, you know, erotic, darkly erotic kind of connection, which I initially, you know, didn't deliver. I mean, I think I got the first minute or so right. And then, you know, there was this sense of when it came. So firstly, there was a sense of when Matthew says, are you ready? You know, and they're preparing for this, the vampire bite. Yes. Which we all know is a sort of erotic, extremely dark and erotic thing as well. You know, I didn't deliver something initially that was dark enough. And then when she is in the throes of, let's be clear, orgasmic ecstasy, the responses were, oh, you did that for about 10 seconds. And then you followed the picture as she kind of comes out of that. And we went, no, we want that to go on and on and on for the next 40 seconds. And that was brilliant because, you know, when you get this criticism, you feel often, you know, even after 25 years of doing this job, you always feel a bit deflated and you feel, oh, I haven't got it right. And I've just about learned to go do the note, okay? Do the note, don't fight it, do the note and see where it takes you. And it was exactly the right note and some great. One of the best bits is that, you know, I was so pleased with that. The string writing that I achieved there was I was really pleased with that climactic bit. And that's on version 4 or 5. And then it was like, okay, so then, okay, you've delivered Diana's ecstatic moment. What about Matthew's? And I kind of was not that clear about how to do that at that point. And then it took 2 or 3 more goes to do that. And again, it was like, so you've got to build up to her climax. And then there's another build up to their joint kind of ecstasy. So that's how, and all of that, you're also trying to present to people as a satisfying piece of music that you can listen to in its own right. So it took a lot of, yeah, it took a lot of work. I'd say it probably took me about a week to do that 5 minutes, which normally, you know, we would probably be on about 2 or 3 minutes a day when we're writing this. So, I mean, having said that, that's not taking into account that you might write that 3 minutes 4 times. But yeah, it took a long time. So it took most of a session to record as well. We had a wonderful violinist and cellist, but it took a lot of effort to get just the right balance. So yeah, I mean, it's a case of the more you put in, often you get something better. But I did end up pleased with it. I would just totally admit that I found it a real challenge to do.
It was worth the effort because it was this piece of beauty that just kind of like their reactions never ended.
I was told to not, you know.
Keep it going.
You know, and it's like, how long is this climax?
Oh my goodness. Well, as we begin to close, I just a few kind of hopefully somewhat quick questions. You may have already mentioned it, or we may have already talked about it, but from the season two soundtrack, what do you think is your favorite track?
On the season two soundtrack, yeah, it's interesting. I think for film score purposes, it would probably be the two, the Fire Drake and Transcendence, as cues that I'm most happy with. They're the longest, were the most challenging. I was very happy with The Wedding as well. I was very happy with Elizabethan London. And of course, I'm delighted to have contributed something, to have done a decent cover of Time in a Bottle. So those would be, I think those would be my favourites, you know, because they were such hard work and the mountain got climbed and they come across now as pretty decent pieces of music.
I mean, at least, yeah, a little decent. Yeah, come on.
They took a lot. You know, it takes a lot of work. Other stuff is more, I suppose, you know, about serving the picture. And it's very interesting. Some stuff you record on the day, and you know, the way I'm working is I'm working with 12 strings. That's it. So it's 12 strings and the samples to create this sound. And sometimes, you know, it just, the recording goes particularly well. So, you know, the piece number 10, Louisa de Clermont, the strings are just sensational in that, but it's only a 50 second cue. They just played it so well. You know, remember that we're doing that 50 seconds will probably be recorded in 6 to 8 minutes of studio time. So they've got very little time to deliver a really compelling performance. And so, you know, I get pleasure out of that as well. But I think, as I said, I think it's the longer pieces. Philippe's Last Message as well. I was pleased with that as well. So, I was really, at the end of the day, I felt I delivered 5 hours of music, and I was delighted to find that there was 56 minutes of decent music for the soundtrack.
Well, since I asked you about your favorite track, do you have a preference between your work on season one and your work on season two as far as the soundtracks go?
Well, that's tricky.
Sorry.
No, that's good. It's absolutely right. I deliberately put less of the dissonant music on season two because I have come to suspect that people, particularly in the age of streaming, are perhaps less interested in some of the really dark stuff. So, you know, I could have had Blood Rage cues that went on for longer. I mean, obviously Matthew's Double Life is quite a long cue, and that's kind of quite horror-ish in places. But I have found overall in soundtracks, not surprisingly, people tend to go for the more melodic stuff. So perhaps I feature, perhaps it's a slightly more satisfying album this time around. I don't know. I would just say that I'm pleased that I found new stuff, you know, that I didn't just repeat season one. I think that's what I'm probably most pleased by, that there was lots of new stuff to do and it brought new music out from me. And it will be the same, you know, it'll be the same in episode season three, which is just starting now. You know, I'm just starting to look at the first cuts of season three, and it will be the same challenge again. It's like, you know, we want it to be familiar, but we also want to be taken on a journey that feels new as well.
Absolutely. And so you answered that other question for me. I was about to ask if you have already started on season three. So
yeah,
you have.
Season three, they managed to shoot during lockdown. I think there have been a couple of shutdowns. I hear through the grapevine that things have had to be postponed on occasion because a cast or crew member has got COVID. But, you know, already we've got the first two episodes are seem to be in very good shape, and more is coming online. And, you know, it'll preoccupy me now from now until October. So they've done really well to kind of film during such a difficult time, you know.
Oh, yeah, they're very, very lucky, like so many other productions. I don't know that they've been shut down, although some like Discovery Witches have been paused several times.
That's right. I think the problem is that when they pause, they have to pause for 10 days.
Oh, I see.
I mean, don't quote me on that, but I think that has happened a couple of times. And so they are, you know, a bit behind in certain places, but they'll absolutely make that up. And remember, we've got seven episodes this season, and I think almost five are almost fully shot. So they've done incredibly well. So we will be going on another journey for season three, and that will hopefully, well, I know it will require me to kind of look for the places where I want to reiterate stuff that's happened and also write new things.
Is there anything that you wanted to put into the soundtrack or season two that didn't make it?
There's, let me think. I mean, the you could put a lot more in. And I think that one of the things is that when you do a soundtrack, you're always slightly torn between, is it possible that people will listen to this and just let it run rather than downloading specific tracks, you know, that they happen to like? Let's conceive this as an album. So actually, I mean, some of the starts you'll notice are we got them as good as we could, but some of them do necessarily jolt a little because the album is designed to also be listened to on a run. And I think that's very much the two things that are going on for me there are I want to try and keep this in chronological order. So I'm obviously going to put Elizabethan London and Matthew's Double Life before the Far Drake Emerges and Transcendence. That's just the way I chose to do it. I think that it benefits from having the story chronologically. And so it then becomes like, all right, so we put the big opening titles in, which is a new thing this year. Okay, we set off on Elizabethan London, which is obviously a strong cue from season one. Okay, we've done something upbeat, now let's go dark. And once we've gone something dark, then now we need to do something that leads us off in a different direction. So if you're listening to the album, it there's enough contrast and light and shade. So actually, I mean, there are always more things that you could put on, but I tend to have this sort of thing of, what do I want to hear next? You know? So, okay, we've heard, we meet John Dee, that's a short cue. You know, we've got Matthew being dark and his remorse over the killing of Cordwell. That's all very stringy and dark. So, right, the next episode is episode four. Right, well, I'm going to start with something very contrasting like Marcus and Phoebe, which is very electronic, as a deliberate contrast to what went before, rather than starting with, say, the opening string cue of episode four. So that tended to be what, you know, what felt good after the last cue, and what comes chronologically were the two things that were kind of determining it. And just, you know, not wanting to overdo it, you know. I mean, obviously, I delivered 5 hours of music. Not all of it is great. You know, you don't want to listen to 5 hours of it. I'll just give you the best hour.
Is there anything, we know you said season three, is there anything before we close out that you would like to share or that you can share of something you're working on?
No, there isn't actually. I haven't done anything more at this precise point of looking at the new cuts. So we go through a long editing process, and I've been kind of helping the editors, if you like, cut to music from seasons one and two. And then what happens is that sometimes that stuff sticks and they go, yeah, that theme works really well. But, you know, my actual, the moment where, if you like, I'm at the sort of top end of the factory, as it were, and everything comes to me to finish, that's like a couple of months away yet. So there isn't anything yet to share, but I'm sure it's going to be a really good season. And it's going to be interesting. You know, it's 7 more episodes to complete the third book.
It's just so much to look forward to for fans who haven't seen the complete season two. Yep. There's so much to look forward to. And if you're listening to this, just in case, you know, maybe wait till you've finished. But if you made it to here, it's a little bit late now. But thank you so much, Mr. Rob Lane, or Rob. I'm so sorry. I'm not sure exactly.
Call me Rob.
Rob.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Rob, again, for being so generous with your time and for joining us and telling us so much about the process and specifically the development of this soundtrack, which is for both my sister and I, again, Summer, she wished she could be here. For both of us, book two out of this trilogy is our favorite. Philippe is my favorite character outside of Diana, of course. So really seeing his story, and it's so little we get of it that, and you already said it without me even saying anything. From what I've experienced and from what all of my friends who have seen it, say in the UK, who have seen the episode say, for me, episode six, it's Philippe's, yes, it's the wedding, but it's Philippe's episode.
Yeah.
It's my favorite of the 10.
Yeah, it was a really good episode. I agree.
Oh, and then after that, it would be 209. And
fantastic.
Oh, so much, so much. So thank you so much for kind of taking us through your journey of the season. And we are so much looking forward to season three, even though I know we have to get through season two first. And we would love to be able to invite you back to speak about that when the time is right.
I'd be very happy to do that, Ginger. Love to.
Thank you so much, Rob. We wish you a great evening, a great rest of your day, and we will speak again.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.